Welcome to a special bonus episode of the This Is Money podcast. I'm Simon Lambert, and joining me on the show today is Alistair Humphreys, author, adventurer, and a star about 4 years ago of a special This Is Money podcast when we did a series called Making the Money Work with Andy Peters, of all people. I interviewed Alistair with Andy, and he talked about his life as an adventurer and how you structure your personal finances to deal with such an odd job. I recently read Alistair's new book, Local, where he explores the area around him rather than traveling to far-flung corners of the world. And I thought it would be a good idea to get back in touch and catch up with him and find out a bit more about Local, about what he's been up to, and about the interesting thing that he told me in one of his emails when we were corresponding recently, that he's become a fan of index investing funds. Alistair, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I'm not a normal visitor to money type podcasts, so I'm looking forward to the chat.
Okay, and first of all, Alistair or Al, which one should I call you?
My friends call me Al. Go for that.
Okay, I'll call you can call me Al. Yeah.
Yeah,
Good.
yes.
Yeah, bet you haven't heard that joke before. So first off, tell us a bit about Local. It's a bit different to your usual books, isn't it? What was the idea behind it?
I think to explain Local, I should probably very briefly explain that my earliest adventures and books and life have all been about chasing huge adventures. So I cycled around the world for 4 years. I've rode across the Atlantic Ocean. I've crossed deserts, walked across India. This big kind of expeditions and journeys, and they're all fantastic. I love them. It's a real privilege to do trips like that, but we can't all be just jetting off and having the trip of a lifetime all the time. What do we do to try and live adventurously in normal times? And then also, I suppose in there was my word jetting off. Increasingly, there's a concern or a terror of the catastrophic impact that we're having on the planet, and it started to just feel inappropriate to me as a lover of wild places to be trashing them by jumping on planes and flying off to these different places. So a few things were percolating in my head to start me asking, is there a way to have adventure close to home, to find nature and wildness close to home, and to really squeeze this in around the edges of our busy, daily, real working lives? So I decided to turn a closer eye to my home, to where I live. And I don't live anywhere particularly exciting. It's a sort of semi-suburban, semi-rural sort of place. And to be honest, I don't really like it. It's quite boring. I wish I lived in the mountains, in a log cabin somewhere. So I'm often a bit grumpy about where I live and wishing I was away on big adventures. So I decided to try and change that again by looking more closely and seeing what was really on my doorstep. So I bought the Ordnance Survey map that covers where I live, and all of Britain's covered by about 400 Ordnance Survey maps. So wherever you live, you can get the map, covers where you live, and it's an area of about 20 kilometers by 20 kilometers, divided up into 1 kilometer grid squares. And my idea was to go out just once a week, so not too big a commitment, and just explore a single grid square, 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer. Not really a big deal, not a huge burden of time and effort. Go out and try to see everything. Is it possible to see everything in 1 kilometer? And then I'd come home and write about it 52 times. So through the course of a year. My worry at the start of the project was that one map would be far too small for me, that I'd get claustrophobic and filled with wanderlust. But by the end of the year, I'd realized that actually that single map was way too big for 1 year of exploring, and I barely touched the sides of it. So it helped change my perspective on lots of things, on where I live, on what adventuring means, and our relationship with nature and wildness. Sorry, that was a very long monologue.
No, it's interesting because I think when most of us think about traveling or going places, we obviously think about going places that are further away than close to our homes. Yet, what I really liked about the book when I read it was this idea of, well, how well do you even know the area near you? Now, I live in the same town that I grew up in. I moved away, lived in London for 15 years, and we ended up moving back 4 years ago. And I know the countryside around here pretty well, having roamed around it as a child, roamed around it as a teenager, definitely, and then, cycled around it and walked around it. But actually, when I look at the OS map that I've got that covers where I live, and I do have one on the wall, there's loads of bits there that I've just never bothered to go to because they just didn't look that interesting. There wasn't anything to get me there. And you tend to just go back to the same places again and again and again, don't you? So did you approach this with the same degree of excitement that you would approach one of your normal adventures?
The honest answer is no. I really did not approach this with the same amount of excitement as a classic type of adventure. And I also know this area really well from many years of cycling, biking, wild camping, running, loving being in the outdoors. And I had the same thing of realizing that once I actually started to pay attention, wow, I know so little about this place. And I think the single thing I did that really helped me and over the year was I didn't just look at the map and choose somewhere interesting to go this week. If you're a map geek or somebody who likes adventuring, you're probably, well, I love to get maps and I look at them and immediately start thinking, oh, that looks like an interesting hill. Or, oh, look how that woodland connects that river. That'll be a fun place to go. So I can easily plan interesting routes and visits on maps. But there's a confirmation bias at work there. And all I would have done if I carried on like that was just go to see all the nice woodlands, which is what I go and see anyway. So I came up with a system to just choose the grid square on the map at random. I used a random number generator to just pick for me the grid square that I'd have to go to this week. And this was what really revolutionized the year because suddenly I was being sent off to industrial yards or crumbling old factories or the back end of some town that I didn't really think was very nice and places that I wouldn't necessarily have chosen to go. And then it was up to me to be interested, to pay attention, to look for nature and wildness and interesting curiosities. And I started to find that the more you are interested in something, the more interesting it becomes. And then you get a lovely positive feedback loop of just realizing there's more and more and more stuff to learn about everywhere you go. And so each week I'd go to these grid squares, chosen at random, and I'd write notes of everything I saw. And then I'd come home and I'd spend at least the same amount of time, a few hours, Googling and Wikipediaing everything I'd seen and just learning all sorts of random stuff about history, culture, nature, geography. I tried to take the approach that everything is interesting. So, for example, one week I saw a sort of manhole cover and it had a website on it. And so I wrote down that website and then went learning about different types of manhole covers. And if you approach anything with enough curiosity, it becomes interesting.
And did you apply any rules that meant that it wasn't totally random, that meant that you were avoiding perhaps ending up in a town more often than you'd want to end up in a town, ending up in a grid square next to another grid square? I'm thinking about if our listeners are thinking, do you know what? This is actually quite a good idea. I could get a whole year's entertainment out of a very, very small outlay of money, i.e., one OS map and a bit of my time. I could do this. But I'm concerned that when I do my map, I'm just going to keep ending up on residential streets.
Well, that slightly depends upon where you live. And what I so at the start of the year, I said that I don't really like where I live. It's a bit of boring, suburban-y, flat, farmlandy, edge of city, there, a bit average. And I wished it was in the Highlands of Scotland. But actually, by the end of the year, if I'd spent a year exploring a map in Scotland, that would have been lovely. 52 mountains to climb, that would have been great. But by the end of my year, I realized how interesting it is to live in a different sort of environment. What that showed me is that no one's map is better or worse. And that's the great thing about this is that the map that you live on is equally as valid and interesting as my map. And the other thing about it is that when you go out to explore your map, you will be excited and interested by different things to me. I don't know, you might be into phone boxes or Morris dancing or punk rock or who knows what it
How
might
did
be.
you know all of the things I'm
I'm
into?
just reading the books behind you on your bookshelf. And so everyone will find their own things that are interesting. And so, of course, then you can make up whatever rules you want for this thing. The only rule that I had was to not go to adjacent squares. 20 by 20 means there's 400 grid squares to cover in only 52 weeks. So it seemed a shame to me to cover to go to adjacent ones. But beyond that, I did just allow the randomness to decide. And there were some times when I think, oh, I'm a bit bored with life, a bit depressed. What I really want to do is go to some lovely countryside this week. And I'd roll the dice and it would send me off to some industrial park. And I'd be a bit grumpy and I'd look on the map and it didn't look like there's anything there. And then I'd get there and it'd be fascinating. I'd meet some interesting person or find some new crazy stuff, or I'd see some sort of bird that I'd never knew about before. And actually, the more random grid squares generally were more rewarding and enjoyable than a nice grassy hill. And I guess the reason for that is because I've spent a lot of time on nice grassy hills. And so this was a way of me being a bit of an explorer, finding newness and variety within the structure of the familiar.
And do you think there's a mental state you need to get yourself into to be an explorer in that self, to turn this into an adventure? Because you said about I'd find interesting things, I'd look them up, I'd work out what that bird was, or I'd see someone and I'd talk to them. I guess there's quite a risk nowadays, in particular, that people would go off to their grid square armed with their phone, you know, however they get there. They might sit on their phone on the way there, sit on their phone on the way back, wander around. Never talk to anyone. When they sit down in nature and have their cup of coffee or their sandwich, get their phone out, do a bit more screen time, and then off they go home. You're not going to get the same out of that if you don't go approach it with an open mind and the willingness to go talk to people and find out new things, are you?
Yeah, you need an open mind and open eyes, open ears, and for me to travel slowly. I'm quite a hyperactive sort of guy. So I took with me a camera, not just the camera on my phone, but a proper camera, in order that every week I would really pay attention to trying to take nice photos, interesting photos, trying to find the beauty of everything. You know, I'd be down on my knees taking a photo of a smashed beer bottle, for example, because if you take it right, that could be a lovely photo, you know. So, and then that would get me to slow and slow and slow. And the reason I was writing the notes in my notebook was to avoid me ending up just doing too much screen time. Having said that, a phone was a very useful tool for me. It felt like a professor and a partner. I'd use a map app, the Ordnance Survey app, to help me navigate around the grid square. And then I used a couple of apps. Most things I'd look up later, but some things I had to look up at the time. And two fantastic apps were one's called Seek, where you aim your phone, the camera at a plant or an insect or whatever, any sort of living thing, and it tells you the name of it. And suddenly, once you can put a name to a species, you start to get a connection and you start to notice it more often and be more interested in it. So Seek was fantastic. And then the other one, which was wonderful, is called Merlin, which listens to bird song and tells you the name of the bird. So suddenly you're not just listening to the lovely tweet, tweet, tweet of the dawn chorus in May or June, which we all enjoy, but to be honest, most of us don't really know what we're listening to beyond a seagull and an owl or a cuckoo. And suddenly
Even
now,
then.
yes, suddenly now I was like, oh, that's a black cap or a goldfinch. And suddenly you get it just really adds to it. So Merlin and Seek were they felt like my digital professors. But I didn't listen to music when I was out on the squares because I wanted to be immersed, and I made sure that I didn't go down the rabbit hole of thinking, oh, I'll just check my email, and then suddenly you've wasted an hour and wasted half of your life.
I've got the Seek app on my phone. My wife has as well, and it's actually one of the best tools we have for getting our youngest daughter out of the incredible grump that she's in because we've just dragged her on a walk. Just finding a bit of fungi and then like shining the phone at it so she can work out what it is. It normally tends to work a
Yes,
treat. So.
phones are a good distraction. That's a good way of taking a phone addicted youth and giving them outdoors. Another good thing for younger children is geocaching, which are these little plastic Tupperware pots with little trinkety gifts in that are hidden all over literally the planet. There's one on the space station, they're everywhere. There'll be one within 2 miles, a mile of where you're listening to this now. And you can give the geocaching app to a kid, and then it becomes like a digital treasure hunt. Follow this thing off down into the wood, and you'll find the little treasure. So yeah, that geocaching is another one to go on the Seek list.
So, having read the book, I know the answer to this question roughly about sort of how much of your map when you looked at it was open countryside, woods, you know, was nature, not towns, not people's houses and gardens. I know it was quite a lot, but how much of that were you actually allowed in?
Yeah, I live in a fairly built-up area. But of course, around there's lots and lots of fields. I mean, unless you're right in the heart of a city or a really big town, then most of us live pretty close to farmland and fields and some sort of greenness. And I'd always thought that was really nice. But what struck me on this project was how much of that was off limits. How often I came up against "keep out, go away, private, no trespassers, get off my land, you're going to be shot" kind of signs. And one of my aims had been to try to immerse myself in my community and to get to know it better, and perhaps therefore to care about it more and feel more connected to it. But I found that very hard to do when everywhere I went were these signs saying, "Get out my land, get out my land." And it really, that was one of my biggest surprises of the year, was how much that bothered me. Now, if it had been, say, some pristine nature reserve with wonderful biodiversity in it and really protecting nature, then of course I'd welcome the keep out signs. But it's not, it's just farmland, which is in Britain is so degraded. We've lost so much of our nature. It's just a wreck. It's like a green desert we tend to live in. So being told to keep out of this land, I found started to really grate with me. And so I would generally just ignore those keep out signs and just generally go off gently trespassing. So wandering around woods. Of course, I wasn't walking straight through crop fields and things. So I was paying, treating farms with respect, but a bit of woodland, no one's there. Yeah, I'd go and walk around it and explore it. And of course, I'd find nobody there and I'd leave no trace and cause no problem at all. So the issues of access and our connect how connected we are as a society to a nature really started to rear its head with me in this year. And the final thing on that that really struck me was that I'm a middle class, 6 foot tall, white bloke. And so I knew that if a farmer caught me, then the worst that was probably going to happen was he'd shout, "Go away, get off my land." But the reality is, I'm quite a sort of jovial, posh guy, and I'd probably go, "Oh, hello, Joe." And within a few minutes, we'd probably be having a cheerful old chat about something, and it'd be fine. And it made me realize how much less accessible the countryside is to pretty much any other demographic. You know, if I was a woman or a young black kid wandering around the woods, it'd be the reaction might well be quite different. So yeah, I became interested in the access to or lack of access to our land in a way that I certainly hadn't expected at the start of the year. Having said that, I don't want to put people off doing this project. So the plus side is the wonderful footpath network we've got. You know, 140,000 miles of footpaths in England and Wales. So even if you're not fancying hopping over a fence to go look in the woods, there are so many public footpaths everywhere, and that is an asset that most countries in the world don't get to enjoy.
Yes, and I mean, there's a lot of debate at the moment about the right to roam and access to the countryside. And it's one of those things that unfortunately seems to tend to get politicized when actually it's a completely, across the board issue. It doesn't matter whether you're left wing, right wing, or somewhere in the middle. The ability to, wander around your own countryside if you're not doing any damage to people, or you're in some, or if you're not in someone's personal space or business space, or wandering through the middle of their crop field. Then, walking through a wood, walking around the edge of a field, not doing any harm, does it really matter? One of the things that comes up is the, well, we've got footpaths and bridleways. But you do realize when you're wandering around the countryside that, yes, those are amazing. But if you only confine yourself to them, you are only confining yourself to a straight line, or not a straight line, a wiggly line in some cases, that isn't very wide and doesn't access a lot of the countryside. And it was interesting what you said there. Because I mean, I like a cheeky trespass as well. I quite like a little wander and an explore. But I've always got in my head, a plausible excuse. This is all people want, really, isn't it? A plausible excuse. Oh, sorry, I thought it was a footpath. Oh, sorry, I thought I was allowed here. Oh, sorry, I saw a hare and I was just following it, kind of thing. And then a little apology and off you go, kind of thing. But there is a thing in your head, even when you're prepared for that, there is a thing in your head where you feel, I shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be here. I've got to have my excuse ready. I need to not get into an argument. I need to make it that even if they're rude to me and I'm polite to them, I don't get drawn into it. And then when you think about so many of those places that you're theoretically not allowed, you think, well, why? Why wouldn't I be allowed here? I mean, there's an example near my house. There's three houses, some business premises, a clinic, some stables. They're up a private drive, but it's not a private drive because all of those things are there. And in fact, there's so much stuff there that there's two car parks. Yet there are signs at both ends of that private drive, not allowed here. Now it connects between two footpaths, and I'm pretty sure there's a fair few people who'd like to walk up there. But I'm also pretty sure that there wouldn't be that many people who walk up and down there. But why wouldn't you? Why shouldn't you be allowed to walk up and down there? Do you think that we need a right to roam or better access to the countryside?
I definitely do. And I think the way that we need to do it is to not make it an for it to stop being an us v them battle. For example, so just in terms of simplifying this, not a farmers versus hikers battle, because I think there's a lot of mutual interests at heart here. The farmers love the landscape, walkers love the landscape. Everyone can agree on that, but there seems to be such a division. And I think the sort of you can look at it in a sort of negative way. So for example, we've got terrible problems at the moment with our rivers being polluted. A lot of that is by agricultural runoff from illegal use of fertilizers and things like that. So there's a lot of bad stuff going on in the countryside, and no and us general plebs, us normal people walking around, we don't get to really see that, or we don't notice it because we're removed from the land, we're disconnected from it. And so I think if we were more connected to the landscape, we'd be more caring about it and more likely to hold these things to account, and hopefully therefore care for nature a bit more. A more positive way of looking at it is that if we get more access to the countryside, we spend more time in the outdoors, we start to feel a bit more connected to it. We'll learn more about what goes on with farms and the importance of farming and farmers, and then we might be more interested in paying fair prices for food rather than supermarkets screwing farmers into the ground. And we'd start to be some more on the side of farmers and working together for a nature-based farming and regenerative agriculture that can make it a better place for nature lovers, hikers, and for farmers. So, but as long as it's a us v them thing, then I think it's a really difficult bridge a difficult thing to bridge. For example, some of the final little thing I'll say on this is whenever you start to have a right to roam discussion, immediately the people who are against it start saying, yeah, but what about litter and dog poo bags and things? And I think this is symptomatic of the problem, because the people are only going to be dropping litter in the countryside or leaving those stupid dog poo bags lying around if they don't care, if they don't feel connected, if they don't feel responsible. And therefore, if we are to have a right to roam, I believe the better way to say it is a right to roam responsibly. So we need the responsibilities for the land, the education that comes for us feeling caring, connected, as well as the rights of access. But it does seem like a very intractable chicken and egg situation.
And that is a similar system to the one that they have in Scotland. I mean, we have it in our own country. We have it in Scotland, don't we? There is that caveat that you must be responsible. You must leave no trace. And in fact, it's better rather than leaving no trace, leave it better than when you arrived. If you see some litter, pick it up, isn't it? But there's a big argument about this at the moment with Dartmoor, isn't there? And some of the argument that's been put forward there was the COVID boom in people going wild camping, litter being left, mess being left, therefore people should just have this right removed from them forever. It's a difficult one, but you do think that perhaps if we're going to fund farmers in a different way, if we're going to subsidise landowners in a different way to how they have been subsidised in the past with the EU subsidies, then perhaps that should come with a trade-off that says, well, do you know what? We should open up the land to people, and if they're not causing any harm, if they're not wandering in people's gardens, if they're not in business premises, if they're not wandering through the middle of your crops, then that's fine.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with all of that, and it is a tricky thing. But a large amount of farmers in the UK are propped up pretty heavily by subsidies, and that's fine by me because I want to eat some food. So that's fine by me. But rather than propping them up with subsidies for harmful environmental practices, as has been the case with a lot of intensive agriculture, why not make the subsidies be much more nature-based, nature-friendly, nature-positive, regenerative farming, and as you say, coming with some with a few strings attached of increasing access, which is so important for people's mental health, physical health, and feeling connected enough with nature to start taking individual and collective action to fix a lot of the mess that we're in.
One of the things that we're also talking about a lot at the moment in terms of Britain and the countryside is building more homes. And this is a real political hot potato. I'm not going to chuck you under the bus with it,
No,
but
please do.
you have spent more time than most people exploring the area where you live and how it fits together and understanding where there are places people live, where there are places people don't, where there are places that are valuable to nature or beautiful, and where there are places that are, not so much, and where there are places that are just sort of post-industrial, slightly wastelandish kind of thing. What do you think about this need to balance building more homes with looking after nature and the environment, and also with what we were just talking about, with giving people access to the countryside?
Before I started really paying attention to where I lived, I would have described it as being very much a built-up area, very much covered with new build communities, new build towns, sort of green belt disputes about building new stuff, new stuff, houses being built. That would be very much my feeling of it. By the end of a year, going all the way around my map, and I should say actually, to finish off the project, I decided to go on a longer adventure by cycling through every single grid square on the map in a sort of crazy spiraling shape from the outside. So a 400 kilometer, well, minimum 400 kilometers, about 300 mile bike ride, never more than about 10 miles from my home, going through every single grid square on my map. So really paying close attention to where I live. And what I realized by the end of it was that where I live isn't very built up at all. Urban stuff, the urban sprawl covers such a tiny percentage of our country and of our planet. And it really worries us because it's very visible, but it's a tiny thing compared to agriculture. And agriculture was something that I'd never really paid very much attention to in my life before. I grew up in a farming community, but I never really paid that much attention to it until I started to realize in my year just how vast an area of my map of our country, of the world, is used in order to grow crops, to feed to animals, which are then fed to humans. And the spectacular calorific inefficiency of this is totally and utterly nuts. So that is the urban sprawl thing and the green belts. These are, of course, important and emotional issues. But in terms of actual space and nature, they are tiny and minuscule compared to the impact of the foods we choose to eat.
And so, did you see places where you thought, do you know what? If they did want to build some houses, they could put some houses here. And did you then see places where you thought, do you know what? If they do decide to build some houses, they'll probably put them here, but they'd probably be better off over there?
My honest answer to that is no. I never really looked in things in that way. And I guess there's two reasons for that. One is that I've got a home, and so I don't really go around looking for where other homes should be built, which is bad of me. And I'm glad that there are people addressing these things, but it's not something that really factors in me. And if I had seen areas of land, my very, very strong thought would have been about, oh, that looks like a fantastic area to rewild, to bring back nature, which I suppose turns me into a classic NIMBY type person. The only thing I would say in my defense is that I wasn't looking in order to choose places for housing, but that would be a good way for me to head out and approach my map. I mean, that'd be a really interesting thing, actually, for me to go out and consciously think, right, we need 10,000 homes on my map, Humphreys. Where are you going to put them? That's it. I like that idea.
I think it's an interesting approach because I actually think we'd end up with a better scenario if people did that. If planners or, if it was removed from the hands of developers and landowners, who unfortunately, the way the system works at the moment is, farmer or someone owns a field, house builder options it for lottery style winning money. If at the stroke of a planner's pen, it gets allowed to be houses built on it, developer builds some houses that quite often turn out to be quite low quality. makes out like a bandit, and the people who previously backed onto fields or open land now have houses behind them, and we move on and do the same thing again. I do think it'd be interesting to go around like that, and I must admit, I do that because of my job, because I'm a financial journalist and we cover property and mortgages and housing, and I've been doing it for 20 years. So I've seen this argument go on. And also because I'm someone who grew up not properly in the countryside, but on the edge of the countryside. And I live on the edge of the countryside now, and I value the countryside. And I saw actually through COVID how much people did, and the escalation of people doing it. And I've always thought that whilst I agree with trying to stop sprawl, what it leads to is this practice of just building on the edge of where people live, and it pushes everybody in the town a bit further away from the countryside. So all those people who used to have to walk 10 minutes to the countryside now have to walk 20 minutes, and all the people who had to walk 20 minutes now have to walk 30 minutes, and you detach people from it. And I always think there must be a better way of doing this, either this kind of hub and spoke idea of building spokes of countryside going into towns, or even I was wandering around before, actually before this recording, I was thinking about this. I went out for a walk and I thought, why do we always build on the field next to the houses that people already live in? And then the people in the houses get grumpy because they used to have a field behind them, and they were lucky, but they did also value it, and they used to have a field behind them, and now they're grumpy because they've got houses behind them. And the people in the new houses also have houses behind them because they're behind the houses that were already there. I was like, why don't we just build in the next field? Because that doesn't create that much more sprawl. And it means that the people in the existing houses still have open space behind them. The people in the new houses have open space behind them. And everybody wins. And what you do with the field that you would have built on is you turn it into publicly accessible land rather than just a wheat field that is a wheat field 1 year, a barley field next year, and so on, going back to what you were just saying. I just feel we don't really put a lot of thought into these kind of things.
I like your idea. I like your idea. I can't actually claim to be able to add anything intelligent on top of your suggestion there. It's not my forte. But the only thing I would say to you though, which is tacking slightly, is you say that there's a lot of countryside where you live. I challenge you then to take off your house building eyes, your eagle eyes for that, and have a look at the countryside near to you and ask what it's being used for. Because except for the little bits that are actually wild, how much of the so-called countryside, and we love our countryside, but until you start to realize that often it's a green monoculture desert, and how much of the countryside near to you is being used in the insanely inefficient ways of growing something to feed to something to feed to something else to feed to you, and what that land could be used for if it was used for different sorts of food growing.
And actually, on that point, one of the interesting things I saw in the book was you picked out lots of places where you found nature in places where you wouldn't necessarily have expected to find nature. So, you said, look at the countryside, see what's actually there. Is it actually, good for nature? Is it natural land, or is it just a massive whacking great field that's a monoculture? But in the book, you describe lots of places where it is a bit industrial, or it was once industrial, and it's been overgrown. And it was there that you seem to be finding lots of nature.
Yeah, very much so, which th added an extra layer of hesitation for me when you asked me about where I should build the houses on my map. Because the inclination, I think, before I'd started this project would be to say, oh, just down the road there where that old factory used to be, that's all a bit sort of scuzzy and rubbishy, and there's lumps of concrete and some old bushes and things. I'd go build some houses there. Don't build it in that lovely bright green farmer's field. That's lovely countryside. But actually, I was finding that these sort of broken down, forgotten, neglected areas, they're free of chemicals. They're the places that are full of wildflowers and butterflies, and foxes, and all the owls and things that come along with that. So yeah, I really found there was a lot more nature and wildness in these broken down, semi-rewilding areas. And that's why I came. We talked earlier about how I initially thought I'd like to go to the woods and the fields, but I actually came to really enjoy the sort of broken down industrial yards, or the verges of motorways, all these weird little areas that I was suddenly exploring had a lot more wildness than I'd ever given them credit for beforehand.
To go back to your previous career as an adventurer and some of your other books. How many books have you written now?
16 or 17, I think. It's good that I'm starting to lose count.
Wow, that's a lot of books. Well done. One of your
Nobody buys them, but I've written a lot.
one of your most famous ones was Micro Adventures, and that's something that we talked about on the podcast with Andy Peters. And the idea behind that was that again, you could get out and have an adventure close to home. And what I liked about that with my financial journalist head on was it was a kind of money saving adventures, you know, because you weren't really spending any money. Tell us about the micro adventure concept, and has that taken on a life of its own after you wrote the book? Do you get people talking to you about that all the time, I would imagine?
Yeah, Micro Adventures is 10 years old this summer, the book, and that was my first attempt really to try and find a way to help normal people with normal lives living in normal places to find adventures, to squeeze adventures in at the weekends or summer evenings or even winter evenings. You know, if you're the sort of person who would love to cycle across a continent but you can't because you haven't got the time or the money, you then have a choice to either just sit at home feeling grumpy about it, or maybe where could you go this weekend? Could you go while camping, while swimming? Could you ride somewhere you've never been before and get the train home? So these sort of small adventures were what micro adventures were all about. And they were, that book's probably been my most successful book, certainly in terms of influence of changing people's behavior and changing their approach to adventure and helping get lots of people out into the outdoors and having small adventures close to home. And it's 10 years old, but it's a really nice book. It's colorful, it's fun, it's got loads of ideas in it. And when I started this map project, I thought I was going to be writing Micro Adventures book two. I thought I was going out to write a book about, hey, here's lots of cheerful, fun adventures to have within 10 miles of your home. But in the course of really paying attention to the year, that's when it turned into being much more of a nature and environmental rant rather than a cheerful, adventure-y sort of book. But yeah, Micro Adventures was great for just trying to encourage people who like the idea of traveling the world to do a little bit until the time comes for them to disappear off into the sunset properly.
I think you underplay it there. I think actually Local is a really positive book. I thought it was inspirational, to be honest. So there wasn't too much ranting about the
Oh, that's good.
countryside and problems, Alistair.
I'm
And
good.
you're doing a podcast with it as well, aren't you?
Well, I sort of self-publish quite a few of my books these days, which gives you a lot of freedom, gives you a better slice of the financial pie, you might be pleased to hear. It gives you a lot more creative control. So when I'm doing a podcast, all I've actually done is I made the normal book, I made the Kindle book, I made the audio book, which I made myself, and then the audiobook I just sliced it up into chapters and bung it out one chapter a week as a free podcast, which is the sort of thing that a publisher would be horrified at, you know, giving away all your content for free. But I've been a long-term believer that the more stuff I give away for free, the more sales that will eventually come of it. So quite a few of my books are podcasts, but all they are is just one chapter per week.
It's interesting that you say, you know, even as someone who I definitely think counts as an established author, that you've chosen to do quite a lot of self-publishing. Does it work out being that much more financially beneficial? How does it work?
Well, roughly speaking, imagine if you buy a £10 book in the shops from, say, Penguin or HarperCollins or someone like that, the author will get maybe 10%, depending on how good a deal they've negotiated. But 10% is pretty good. I got st stiff for worse than that on some of my early books. So the author gets £1. Self-publish the book yourself, and then you're up to 60%. So you're suddenly getting £6. Make the Kindle book yourself, and you keep all of the proceeds of that because it's free to upload, and Amazon just takes their cut off it. And same with the audiobook. So it's just vastly more better in terms of the percentage slice of the pie. The downside is you have to do all of your own marketing, and you're not as likely to be in the bookshops. But if you're more into the digital world, then perhaps that's something you're willing to tolerate. So there's pros and cons of both, but I like the slice of the pie, and but more than that, I like the creative freedom to be able to just get on and do what I want to do.
And if anybody is listening to this, any of our listeners thinking, oh, fuck, maybe I might self-publish my book, what would be your tips for promoting it and getting it out there? Because presumably that is, as you said, the biggest problem is getting people, getting the horses to water.
Yes, the actual production of the book is ridiculously easy. I mean, you could get some massive Word document off your computer now, pay someone £50 to format it and upload it, and it'll be for sale as a paperback book by the end of the week. It's completely nuts how easy it is to do. But then, who's going to buy this thing? And the way I've done that is to try to give away helpful, useful information to teach people, to inform people, to educate people, or to entertain people about the world of adventure and travel, and to just find a few key messages and repeat that time and again. And if you keep going at that for about 20 years, then you'll be an overnight success.
Now, when we last spoke and we did the Making the Money Work podcast, you admitted to me and Andy Peters. I love saying that, me and Andy Peters. It
Yeah.
always makes me laugh.
That was such an amusing and random thing that I was on a money podcast and there was Andy Peters. So it's surreal. I remember he had very big biceps.
He did have very big biceps. I also remember him having, he has a keen interest in finance because he has a very big bank balance as well.
I'm
I
sure he
remember him
does.
saying that when he first started out, I'm sure he said that his ambition was to have £1 million or something, and he just kept saving up and saving up and saving up until he had it in his bank account. But you told us that you weren't that good with your finances. You told us that your wife was, but that you weren't. Yet, when we were corresponding before this recording, you delivered the surprising news to me that you've apparently become an index fund fan.
Yeah.
Tell me about your adventures in investing.
Yeah, so I've never had any interest in money. I guess my early days of adventuring stuff, I was interested in that I didn't have any, so I had to work furiously and scrabble and scrabble. But I've got to a position now where I'm lucky enough to be able to buy the shopping, fix the dishwasher, stuff like that, without worrying too much, and therefore, which is an incredible privilege. And at that point, I have no more interest in money, really. But I know that it's important, and I'm looking forward to having a nice retirement, surfing in the south of France or something like that. But I'd always sort of slightly buried my head in the sands, and then a bunch of years ago, I gave a talk for St James's Place, and they were horrified that I didn't even have a pension in my 30s. So they signed me up for St James's Place, and I thought, brilliant! I've started saving for this. Everything's done. I'm fine. I'm going to be a millionaire. And then I was a few years ago, I was having lunch with a friend of mine, and I was saying to her, "Oh, money's so boring. I don't understand it. It's too complicated for me." And she got really cross at me, really quite annoyed. She's like, "Just don't be an idiot. You've got a GCSE in maths. This is just a lazy excuse." And she explained to me that the tiny little 2.5% St James's Place were taking from me, how much that might add up to over a lifetime. And she gave me a few books to read, a couple of which were Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and one called someone Collins, like The Road to Wealth or something, Jim's, and a website by, which sounded crazy, Mr. Money Mustache, about FIRE, financial independence and retire early. And I started to read these books, and I found it absolutely fascinating, really interesting, and actually not very complicated at all. And on the back, and then as I tend to do, I got quite obsessed with an activity for a short period of time until I figured I'd learned enough, which in my mind was ditch the expensive pension, move my little bit to Vanguard, shove in as much money as I can possibly manage each month, spend as little money, or sorry, waste as little money as I can. Spend my money on stuff that I care about, but waste very little. Stick it all in that Vanguard, and then forget about it until the time comes to buy a surfboard. I know you're not in a position to offer financial advice. You don't need to tell me if that's a good plan or a bad plan, but I have become a massive index fund bore, much to everyone's incredulity and amusement.
I cannot offer you personal financial advice, Al, but what I can say is that that was definitely a good move. Taking your savings for your retirement and your future that you're slowly building up away from one of the country's most expensive wealth managers and just doing it yourself for a much, much lower cost means that at the end of it, when you've compounded all of those gains up and you're no longer taking 2.5% off it every year, you're going to end up with a much bigger pot for the surfing in the south of France. So, yeah,
Yeah,
good move.
one of my biggest rants now is I'm quite an intelligent chap. I got lots of A levels and a degree. I didn't know about compound interest until I hit 40. Why are we not teaching 11-year-old kids this stuff? This just drove me up the absolutely up the wall. Yeah, I got very excited when I started to learn about compound interest.
Albert Einstein described it allegedly as the eighth wonder of the world. But I think that one of my things that I always say to people, and this is why I say to people to put money into a pension, into their work pension when they're auto-enrolled. And obviously, if you're self-employed like yourself, then it's harder and you have to do it yourself. But if you're employed, is that there's this magical trick with compounding where if you save for 40 years instead of 30 years, you double your money. And that is brilliant. And is the reason why you should start investing a small amount into your work pension when you're in your mid 20s rather than waiting until you're in your mid 30s. Because then when you retire and head off to go surfing in the southwest of France, I'll see you there. You have twice as much money to do it with.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is. And I don't think we teach children anywhere near enough about finance in schools, but I also don't think that we teach them anywhere near enough about finance when they go to university and when they start their first job and things like that.
Absolutely, completely agree. I think I needed to know when I got my very first job in an ice cream van, then working in a pub, of hey, here's a bit of compound interest tips. Start today. I had this idea that I would wait till I got quite rich and then start a pension. And the same, I guess, a similar sort of issue for me is being a self-employed person was suddenly having to start paying tax and things. I did A, I got an A in A level physics. I know a lot about God knows whatever they teach you. I had literally no idea how to do my tax forms. And I still, now, whenever my accountant emails me, I have no idea what they're talking about. So it's completely nuts that we're not teaching this stuff to young people.
It is indeed. And that self-employed thing, it's the put the money aside for tax while you're going along rather than waiting until you get the tax bill and suddenly getting hit with a big tax bill, isn't it?
Yes. Well, luckily, I'm a Yorkshireman, so I've always been quite miserly, which is quite good for that. I think the final thing I'd say on my road to Damascus was it's one thing thinking, oh yeah, compound interest, that's great, and index funds are cheap and great, and this is all good stuff. I would probably have listened to a podcast like this and thought that's a good idea, and then taken zero action on it because it sounded like a hassle. But what really amazed me was how ridiculously easy it's been to set it up. And then now all I do is I just pay in the maximum amount that I can every single month automatically, and I literally never look at it.
Automating it, getting it out of your account as
Exactly.
soon as you get paid, all those little tricks, they make a big, big difference. So after you've finished geeking out on index funds and boring people senseless with your sudden transformation in your investment outlook, what else is on the agenda? What is Alistair Humphreys doing next? Where's the next adventure?
For about 20 years, I've always had exactly the answer to this question of what next, what next, what adventures next. But I really feel at the moment that I just don't know. So writing local was a really big accidental pivot from me, from writing books that encourage people to go into the outdoors and have adventures, towards this book, which is much more about encouraging people to look at the state of nature, realize that it's in a bit of a catastrophe, and hey, what can we do about it? And it feels to me now like that's an important direction that I want to go down next, but I don't really know how best to go about it. Any ideas gratefully received.
Okay. Well, if you have any ideas for Alistair, you can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk and we will certainly pass them on to him. Alistair, that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure and fascinating to hear about local and about all those other things and also about your index fund investigation.
Yeah, don't get to go on many podcasts and let me talk about index funds. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining us. Goodbye.
Thank you.